Homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha. Sound okay everywhere? So this talk is titled One Path, One Dharma. Last month I talked about creating wisdom from ignorance, from the precept, do not dwell on past mistakes. I talked quite a bit about the first paragraph of the commentary about expounding upon error. But I didn't really go into the second paragraph, and I'd like to talk about that part today. So here's the precept. Says, do not dwell on past mistakes, create wisdom from ignorance. In the realm of the flawless Dharma, not expounding upon error is the precept of not dwelling on past mistakes. In the Buddha Dharma, there is one path, one Dharma, one realization, one practice. Do not engage in fault finding. Do not condone haphazard talk. Sometimes when I read or hear in the Buddha Dharma, there's one path, one Dharma, one realization, one practice, I think that's not true. In fact, there are many paths and practices. There are also many teachings and ways of realization. So, what's up with that? I almost titled this talk, The One and the Many, as a way of exploring non-duality, not one, not two. Interbeing, interpenetration, interdependence. And that's certainly one aspect of this sentence, but let's break it down a little bit first. So, one path, one practice. What is this path and practice? We can start by noticing that towards the beginning of the Kyoju Kaimon, it says that when we take refuge in the three treasures, we can have the precepts of the Buddhas completely. The three treasures are the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. All Buddhists, to my knowledge, recognize these three refuges as the core of Buddhist teachings, and many have it that once you do this, you are a Buddhist, and everything else follows from this. This everything else is vast and varied, but we can see it as one Dharma. We can think of it as being a collective noun, like water or rice. One thing that holds many and a lot, depending on how you measure, by volume or counting. In that sense, we are talking of Dharma, capital D, which includes the truth about everything, the highest truth. So now I've jumped from path and practice to the one Dharma. I'll get back to path and practice in a moment, but let's just notice first that these are all intertwined. When we talk about the word Dharma with a small lowercase d, we are talking about the myriad things, all the stuff we see around us. Of the several definitions of Dharma that I found in the Shambhala Dictionary of Buddhism and Zen, the one that fits this one is the manifestation of reality, of the general state of affairs, things, phenomena. The next one is more technical, but it also fits. Mental conduct, content, an object of thought, an idea, a reflection of a thing in the human mind. So now we have an object and the mental reflection of that object, and we're surrounded by these. This sense of Dharma shows up in the First Noble Truth, often mistranslated as life is suffering. Looking at the Sanskrit for this noble truth produces a more accurate translation. All dharmas are marked by dukkha or dissatisfactoriness. What this is saying is that all things or dharmas come into being, abide for a while, change, and eventually fade away, which produces a sense of dissatisfaction. So here's an example. This beautiful lectern used to be a bunch of wood that got cut into pieces and then put together in a particular way with Teijin's considerable skill. Now it is a thing of beauty and functionality, and with any luck, we will be using it for many years. But eventually it will wear out and fall apart and either decay or burn. And in any case, will no longer be even a semblance of a lectern. And of course, at one time, it was a tree, or likely more than one tree, given that there are different kinds of wood in here. And those got cut into pieces. And before that, it was a seed which got planted in the earth and grew with the help of air, rain, sun, earth, and the company of birds, insects, microorganisms, and other beings. This lectern contains all of that and will eventually change into something else altogether. This is a fundamental teaching of Buddhism. All dharmas are empty of separate existence, and everything is subject to impermanence. The impermanence is what leads to dissatisfactoriness or suffering when we cling to something, any small d dharma, without understanding that it is transitory, impermanent, subject to change. And this is how we create suffering for ourselves. Whenever we want something to either stay the way it is or to change in a particular way that is according to a mental idea that we have made up, we create suffering for ourselves and for others as well. And these are not separate. We are not separate. This is the second noble truth. The source of suffering is our own clinging. So just to round out the four noble truths, the third truth is that there is a way out of suffering. And again, the Sanskrit uses the word nirvana, a Sanskrit word, which is usually translated extinction. So I looked that up in the Shambhala Dictionary of Buddhism and Zen. Very nice book. And this is what it says about nirvana. It comes from a Sanskrit word, and it literally means extinction. The goal of spiritual practice in all branches of Buddhism. In the understanding of early Buddhism, it is departure from the cycle of rebirths, or samsara, and entry into an entirely different mode of existence. It requires complete overcoming of the three unwholesome roots, desire, hatred, and delusion, and the coming to rest of active volition. It means freedom from the determining effect of karma. Nirvana is unconditioned. Its characteristic marks are the absence of arising, subsisting, changing, and passing away. In Mahayana, the notion of nirvana undergoes a change that may be attributed to the introduction of the bodhisattva ideal and to an emphasis on the unified nature of the world. Nirvana is conceived as oneness with the absolute, the unity of samsara and transcendence. It is also described as dwelling in the experience of the absolute, bliss in cognizing one's identity with the absolute, and as freedom from attachment to illusions, affects, and desires. In the West, nirvana has often been misunderstood as mere annihilation. Even in early Buddhism, it was not so conceived. In many texts, to explain what is described as nirvana, the simile of extinguishing a flame is used. The fire that goes out does not pass away, but merely becomes invisible by passing into space. Thus, the term nirvana does not indicate annihilation, but rather entry into another mode of existence. The fire comes forth from space and returns to it. Thus, nirvana is a spiritual event that takes place in time, but is also in an unmanifest and imperishable sphere, always already there. This is the abode of immortality, which is not spatially localizable, but is rather transcendent, supramundane, and only accessible to mystical experience. Okay, that's three. The third noble truth says, basically, nirvana is possible. Now we come to the fourth noble truth, which says that the way or path out of suffering is the Eightfold Path. This includes understanding, intention, effort, communication, action, livelihood, mindfulness, and concentration. This may seem like a big detour, but it leads right back to one path. It should be clear that nirvana is not a thing you can decide, oh, that would be nice, and have it drop out of the sky. It involves a whole path of practice, the Eightfold Path. The precepts that we have been studying and that we will be practicing with this week, culminating in giving and receiving the precepts next Sunday at Chukai, are a part of this path, specifically the middle three: communication or right speech, action, and livelihood. The first three steps on the path have to do with understanding all of this, setting an intention around it, and finding the energy to follow through. The last two, mindfulness and concentration, speak to meditation practice. Really, it is all practice. Although the different branches of Buddhism vary in which parts and how much they emphasize different parts of this path, the path itself is again common to all Buddhists. As Dogen says in Fukan Zazengi, although there are 10,000 distinctions and 1,000 variations, all lineages just wholeheartedly engage the way in Zazen, sitting meditation. Several years ago, I was privileged to do a three-month practice period at Tassajara Monastery in California. I was 60 at the time, and it was difficult practice in many ways. I was homesick, missing people at Dharma Rain, not knowing anyone at Tassajara, having never been there before. My back began to spasm, causing a lot of pain with sitting Zazen. I really had to call on all my stubbornness not to quit. And I got through it. That's what you call the virya paramita, or the energy effort. The back slowly loosened up. And about 2 weeks before I left, I suddenly broke through something and saw the Zendo there as being exactly the same as the Zendo here, which wasn't this Zendo where we are today, but the old one on Madison Street. Now, all three of these Zendos are different, in different geographical locations, with different qualities, and yet what became clear to me was that they were all one Zendo. I was at home in any Zendo where people were practicing, regardless of when or where. One of the things I have observed in my work as a Zen teacher is how differently individual people work with the Dharma, and how differently they practice. Sometimes I observe someone else doing something I would never have thought of, and it gives me an idea for something to try for myself. Or I hear of a different interpretation of the Dharma, and it opens my own view of it. However, almost as often I am scratching my head, thinking, how in the world does that work? Or why would anyone do or think that way? And so forth. I've learned to watch with curiosity and without judgment over time. Different things work for different people, or as they say, different medicines for different illnesses. What I look for is positive change, moving forward, and persistence, which is that expression of effort or energy. So all of these can cause me to say, but path and practice are not one, but multiple. And what I'm now seeing is that they are both unique, individual, and the same, universal. Now let's look at that word realization. This dictionary directs me to the word kensho, which is a Japanese word, which literally means seeing nature. This is a Zen expression for the experience of awakening or enlightenment or realization. Since the meaning is seeing one's own true nature, kensho is usually translated self-realization. Like all words that try to reduce the conceptually ungraspable experience of enlightenment to a concept, this one is also not entirely accurate and is even misleading, since that experience contains no duality of seer and seen, because there is no nature of self as an object that is seen by a subject separate from it. Which reminds me a little of the discussion of Nirvana earlier, and in particular, the metaphor of fire disappearing into space, which is where it came from originally. While there may be different ways, and there are different ways, into experience realization, and certainly we can see differences in how that looks from the outside, these are irrelevant to the ultimate oneness of the actual experience. At the Dharma Cloud Day we did last Saturday, Kakumiya said that realization happens in relationship. And one of the things that struck me about that is that this way of looking at it allows for a lot of variation, change, flowing from one state to another, one person to another, and back again. Unique, individual, and the same, universal. Given all of that, it becomes more clear that fault finding and haphazard talk are detrimental to the process of realization. Over time, we learn to see that each person we meet is Buddha, that together we manifest Buddha. We are many, we are one, we are not separate, not two. Fault finding, whether looking at others' faults or our own, is an expression of delusion. We know that we all make mistakes, and that's how we learn. We realize that becoming aware of our mistakes is what leads us into enlightenment, which is the opposite of looking for faults and blame. We learn to exercise care in our relationships with others, paying close attention, listening carefully, practicing loving kindness always. This also applies to our relationship with ourselves. In a story I read, a father and son encounter a cousin who has a very odd way of behaving, trying to act superior and not quite succeeding. After that person leaves, the son asks his father, "Why is he like that?" The father replies, "Well, I guess he's not done yet." And we are none of us done yet. So my teacher Kyogen wrote in an article about Dogen and non-dual, "To start out on the path of practice, we must truly understand the unsatisfactory nature of our own being. Our personalities, our minds, all our wonderful capabilities fall far short of what we would like ourselves to be. Yet this is not a problem. It is the gateway to way-seeking mind. It also offers a clue as to why beginning, middle, and end in Zen are not fundamentally different, and why success and failure are of one essence." Later in the same article, Kyogen quotes Dogen from the Fascicle Daigo, or Great Enlightenment. Dogen says, "In our present study, we are not concerned with the difference between enlightenment or illusion, or Buddhas and ordinary people. Here, great enlightenment is even different from the great awakening of a bodhisattva. Great enlightenment is without beginning or end, and so is illusion." Yogan comments, "This chapter addresses the question of what happens when a person of great enlightenment falls into illusion. Dogen answers the question by equating great enlightenment and illusion. He says, there is no distinction between them. Great enlightenment is not just the function of ourselves or others. It fills everywhere. It is the center of existence in both the form of enlightenment and illusion. Illusion can only seek great enlightenment, and we can never find great enlightenment outside of illusion." Kyogen continues, "This is the important point. We don't have to worry about the fact that we are sometimes confused. It is our very confusion that leads us to the truth." He goes on to say that thousands of years exist in the present, and that our own lives right now are the focal point of Zen study and investigation. And indeed, How could we find the truth anywhere else? So that's what I have for today. Open to comments and questions.
If you have a question and you're in the Zendo, please raise your hand and I'll bring you the microphone. Just say your name and speak into the microphone. If you are in the Zoom room, you can type your name into the chat or your question, and our co-host Jay will read it out loud.
I'm Die Guy. So haphazard talk. When I first read that, I thought, oh no, you know, that's my hobby.
And, yeah.
You know, really. And, you know, more recently I've become so interested in intoxication. My vow actually turned on that. And haphazard talk is a form of pretty immense intoxication, it seems mm-hmm. like to me.
So what does that look like for you?
What does that look like for me? It looks like, you know, the proverbial chicken with the head cut off, right? Yeah, as opposed to something a little more ready to serve others.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I don't know if you want to react to that. Or...
Well, what is intoxicating about that for you?
I think, what is intoxication? It's very hard to say sometimes. The line seems like it's, you know, some form of gentle excitement and enlivening, and then mm-hmm. it gets into, I think it's when I lose track,
uh-huh.
you know, and start being swept away.
So the awareness is not there.
Yeah. Or if it is, it's fragmentary and uh-huh. highly mobile.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And so when you get swept away like that, what happens?
Well, it depends. I mean, it varies from time to time. Sometimes I just keep riding that wave, you know,
uh-huh.
and other times I do a U-turn. Sometimes I just stop. You know, more recently, I think it's like, okay, let's just invite this to come closer.
Uh-huh.
See if I can't unite with it in some way and learn something. Yeah.
Okay. Does it... when I'm saying what happens, what are the effects, I guess, is what I'm thinking is, do you feel like that it's helpful or not?
Which?
Haphazard talk.
I do not think it is helpful.
Okay. Okay. We're getting somewhere.
Yeah, okay.
So you recognize there's a problem there.
Well, yeah, I'm hesitant to call it a problem uh-huh. as much as it, you know, in the spirit of everything that you read there uh-huh. toward the end, you know, it's part of this big gentleness and, uh-huh. You know, but I think ignored, uh-huh. you know, it can lead to yeah. a lot of trouble.
Yeah. yeah. Okay. So you're investigating it and yeah. you're trying to lean into it a little bit and say, yeah. what is this about? And
yeah.
that kind of stuff. Yeah. It's a good strategy. Yeah.
Okay.
Good luck.
Thank you.
This is Mess. I'm continuing with haphazard talk. I find that sometimes talking negatively about others is like, I don't think it's a clean fuel, but it's like a bonding strategy people have. Uh-huh. And I don't particularly like to partake, but I've also noticed the ways that then people like feel judgment or like unsafe around me. And I feel like sometimes there is a fine line of like, maybe I don't agree with someone's actions that are impacting people in my life and how to like,
yeah.
tell the difference.
Yeah, you get into this full right speech business. And that does seem to be one of the big difficulties with it. People, the bonding is a thing. It's like, I think of it as like, well, if we both agree that so-and-so is really messed up, then we can be part of the same tribe. You know, we can like, it's a way of trying to create in a very odd way of trying to create community. But the problem is it kind of leaves other people out and it becomes an othering exercise. I think the way I remember Kyogen at one point, he was talking about something else. He was talking about being in conflict. And what he said was, if you turn, step sideways and try to get the other person to step with you, that's a way of like seeing if you can find a way to work together. So it might be that a gentle reminder that, well, you know, they're not done yet, which I thought that was a brilliant response to that. Like, I think they're probably doing the best they can, or I wonder why that's going on, and I wonder if they're having some problem. I mean, you know, sort of beginning to sort of turn it a little bit. I've heard people just say, I don't really want to talk about other people, which is a little blunt. And like you say, can create kind of a feeling of being judged or something. It just varies so much with the situation and what your relationship with these people. So yeah, it's a tough one because there is that sense of, oh, let's just bond around, like, you know, I had a situation that way where I met some guy right out in front of the Zendo and we started talking and he was like, oh, all these CEOs driving their big cars. And I was like, uh-huh. And then he was like going on. He was like, kept trying to find a common enemy. It was really interesting the way that discussion went. And I finally just said, you know, I have enough trouble trying to figure out how to keep myself going properly without making a lot of mistakes. And I'm not going to judge anybody else. And he didn't know what to do with that. So he just sort of said, okay, whatever. And off he went. I didn't know the guy. I was like, well, it's not a big deal for me. So in that case, you know, my relationship with him didn't necessarily depend on anything. But that's kind of what I come back to a lot of times. I've messed up enough times in my life, and sometimes pretty spectacularly, and I'm not going to judge anybody else.
Thank you.
Hi, this is Dio. I actually had an experience with a learning experience with Haphazard Talk last night, that like stood out to me. I share Daigai's fascination with just saying whatever I think of and making light of stuff. And like when I'm just talking in person, it's much harder to catch it because it just comes out, right? And like usually it's fine. It's not always fine. And that's fine. but I was texting. I worked a really long day yesterday and I was texting my friend and he was like, oh dang, like was any of that overtime? And I was so quick, like if I work more than 40 hours a week, just like take me out back or something. and I typed it and I looked at it and I was like, man, like I'm just kind of poisoning myself with jokes like this. And like, but like being able to see it was really like reflective. And so I changed it to a more wholesome joke, but like,
yeah,
but it's just like interesting how much damage you can do by just like,
right,
talking.
Yeah. And thinking too. So it's like self-talk kind of stuff like that. Yeah. That's all stuff to pay attention to. Good catch. You know, it was like, you don't, like you say, it's hard to catch sometimes when you're in a conversation with someone. But yeah.
Hi, this is Kaylin. And thanks for the talk today. And I also resonate, especially Daigai and Dio's contributions here. I resonate so much. I have really been trying to like practice mindfulness in talking because I can get really whipped up, and but it can be a really joyful experience, and I had that last night too.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a little bit of a thing that I do with people, and sometimes people seek it out. The person who I was with last night was seeking it out a bit, where it's just like you can get into a conversation, like rhythm, like it's like a riff, it's like a jam,
mm-hmm.
you know, and it makes us feel alive. I'm really trying to see if I can do it in a way where it's so much more relaxed. But yeah, and it comes back. There's another way I could view my Ongo vow, and which is really about take care of this nervous system.
Mm.
And yeah, but I'm really struggling with actually, like, I love that. Like, I don't know. It actually does feel sort of sacred to me. And it's like these these energizing conversations, but like, is there a way to do it where it still remains relaxed?
So yeah, what I was struck by that word relaxed. What does that mean to you?
It doesn't necessarily mean like slow, you know, but that it's a difference. It's like, I think of it in terms of almost like playing a game. Are you playing a game to like win or just have a ton of energy or get a high score? Mm-hmm. Or is it like literally a passing of a ball back and forth between mm-hmm. people?
Hmm. Well, I was wondering whether relaxed might have something to do with slowing down or stopping or, you know, pausing of some sort. But it might involve, well, it's a little bit of a step back maybe and looking at it. So thinking of it in a little more neutral way instead of, wow, isn't this fun? It's like, is it really fun?
Yeah, it is.
Okay. It really is fun. Okay. And let's see. I don't know. I'm not quite sure actually how to look at that, but other than just sort of slow down and take a look and see, is this wholesome or not? Because it might be. And so haphazard to me has to do more with that sense of, it might not even mean out of control. It might mean more like, is this wholesome? Maybe that's more like that.
We have a question on Zoom.
This is Jen. I kind of want to piggyback on top of what Kaylin was saying, that like, I feel like there's sort of a question here of like, well, is small talk bad? Like, because it's just kind of whatever. And whatever you want to say, contentless, like not that important. And I guess I just want to say, like, I feel like small talk can serve a lot of really beneficial social, like, sense of ease or companionship, and that, like, even like I might talk to someone, and we might talk about something that's not that important or not that I'm not that mindful of the subject matter, but what's happening between us is this exchange of like, hey, I'm a calm human and I feel friendly towards you, and you're a calm human and you feel friendly towards me. And I think that that has merit.
Right.
I'm curious what you think about that.
I agree with that, that we don't always have to script everything that we're saying. And it's true that when we're talking, it's not always easy to just sort of stop and say, wait, is that what I really mean? And you could do that if you feel like you're getting really like into the weeds or into some place where you don't really want to go. But mostly we're just sort of being with whatever's going on there. And, you know, it's good to kind of watch that, but I don't think you have to have this really tight control over it unless you start noticing that, you know, you're bonding around somebody else's oppression. It's just mostly noticing. A lot of times you notice after the fact, but hopefully at some point that changes a little bit about how you're perceiving what's going on. It's a tough one, I think, to just keep noticing, and then afterwards maybe taking a look at it and saying, oh, you know, yeah, that was fine. It was fun. It was okay. We had a good time. There's nothing wrong with that at all. We're getting into some good stuff here.
Thank you. It's Sarah.
Hi, Sarah.
I was just thinking, I come from a long line, a family of storytellers, and we get together and we like to tell stories, and it gets a little, you know, not so wholesome sometimes. And some of us will call each other out, though. We'll be like, would you say that to that person's face? Uh-huh. You know, we try to tell a story that's from our experience,
right?
And we wouldn't say that thing that happened in our experience if that person were there, right? We'd call each other on that, like, not to talk behind their backs in that way.
Mm-hmm.
So we're you know, we try as a family to be wholesome because there's often small children around. They're listening right. to the stories and they want to repeat them. So that's something I know. I work with small children and homeschool children, and I tell stories and we'll talk about an experience we just had, and they will go into, you know, their anger or their fear or whatever, and express in kind of a habit way that they see other adults tell stories. Mm-hmm. And I'll come back to trying to tell that experience in a wholesome way. So thinking about telling a story to a child or modeling in front of a child is really helpful, I think, in the difference between telling a story and, you know, gossiping or mm-hmm. hurting someone's feelings. So I don't know if that's helpful for other people. It's really helpful for me.
Yeah. I think that guideline about, you know, would you say something to somebody's face like that? Would you say that to that person? I think that's a good thing to kind of check on. Yeah. Right over here.
Hi, Grant here. I was just interested on your thoughts. Where does self-deprecating humor cross the line into bad talk and general insight?
Okay, so first of all, I'd like to take the word bad out of this conversation. But yeah, self-deprecation, and it's not that different from deprecating, you know, from like trashing somebody else. It's actually, it's all part of the same thing in my mind. And I will say that it's one of those things, I really enjoy watching comedy, and it's one of those things that comedy can get over the line for me about, you know, because a lot of it, yeah, there's a lot of it that kind of depends on that, you know, it depends on, look at this horrible person over here. And so, and the same thing is true as look at this horrible person right here, because I've certainly done a certain amount of that. And all of that is a way of separating, and it's a way of delusion, saying somehow that person's not the same as me. They're somehow much worse than me. Praising self, blaming others kind of thing. It's all that part of that same thing. And that's where we get into trouble with it. But finding that line is difficult, as you say. You know, how do you tell the truth about someone? You tell the truth about someone or about yourself by sticking to facts, saying, what is really true here? What do I really know about what's really going on here? Because a lot of times we don't know what's going on. We're just making assumptions that this person is like, you know, whatever it is, this person is really fat, right? That's one of the big ones, or a number of things, but you don't know why that person's fat. Maybe they were born that way, or maybe they, I mean, who knows? There's all kinds of things that can lead to that. And what's the big deal anyway, right? So why is that like supposed to be funny? Because people have fear about it, or I don't know what all. There's a lot of things that get into that. What makes things funny? It's an interesting question, right? So, you know, just trying to be aware, paying attention to what's really true. Can you find something that's really true that is also funny? I don't know, maybe. Or fun, exciting, all of those things that we're looking for here in terms of relating to each other. I think we probably can if we look. But training ourselves to turn in that direction is, that takes time and practice. That makes sense?
Yeah, I find when I meet new people, I always do a self-deprecating joke because it helps the situation to dispel any hierarchy things or anything, just to be like, well, I'm just like you. That's my kind of default, is to self-deprecate. But I know that in that I could be, you know.
Causing harm to yourself.
Causing harm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Kind of like what Gaia was just talking about with this first thought about her text.
Yeah.
Just take me out and shoot me or whatever. I was like, oh, wait. I mean, I think that that's what happens sometimes. So just be careful about it, you know, and notice what happens when you do that. What's the effect on you when you do that?
Thank you.
This is Kristen. What Grant just said just opened something up in my head, and it kind of relates to the other questions as well. But during the self-deprecating speech, thinking is all, I do a lot of it. And it was funny or interesting during the precepts interview with Kakumyo, I let one slip for sure. And I was like, yeah, because I'm lazy. And he was like, wow, you speak really harshly at yourself. And, I don't even realize it. But it, yeah, what opened up in my head was like, would I say that to my face, you know?
Right.
Would I say that to somebody else's face? And right. Like, no, I would never be like, you know, if I saw somebody exhibiting maybe lazy behavior, I would never be like, they're a lazy person. They're lazy. I would never say that. And yeah, right. So why do I allow that in myself?
Yeah. Sometimes we're much more harsh with ourselves than with others. That's true. And it becomes a habit, like you say, it just becomes this habitual thing that we don't even notice, because this is kind of how we do it. And so this is part of what we do with practice, is noticing. When you notice that, you can say, oh, huh, maybe, you know, and as you notice it, it doesn't necessarily mean now you automatically change the behavior, but it means that as you notice it closer and closer and closer to the time when you're doing it, then at some point you can start noticing it coming up, just like Dio did. Like, oh, wait. And then you can change it. So it takes time. Yeah. Okay. Well, we covered it pretty well, we think, maybe, for now. All right. Thank you so much for your kind attention.